Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the Woody Overton Window, the WOW. I am Mike here with my buddy Woody. What's up, Woody?
What's up? Happy Monday. Monday, right?
Monday, July 29, almost done with July.
Yep, I see you have your... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is episode 15. This is our 15th episode.
Rolling along. I see you have your Olympic t-shirt on and hat and your pins. You know, those Olympic pins are a big deal for collectors.
Yeah, I don't. I have a New York Mets t-shirt on, a 1962 New York Mets t-shirt going. But I do plan on getting into some Olympic betting this week now that you've inspired me for that. So I'm trying to determine which of these. I think the swimmers are the best bets for the Americans.
Yeah. Swimmers, maybe the track stuff, right? I like to watch the gymnasts. Since I was a young man and Mary Lou Retton was on air, I'd been in love. And now it's Olivia Dunn, right?
Well, no.
But she's not going to be in Olympics. Yeah.
No, it's Simone Biles is making her big comeback after getting the twisties in the last Olympic game. So that'll be a big deal. But I thought she was a basketball player.
Simone Biles.
Simone Biles?
Yeah.
No, Simone Biles is the greatest U.S. gymnast of all time. She's actually a great story. And she got this thing called the twisties in the last Olympic games, which she came in the odds on favorite. Everybody expected her to win a bunch of gold medals. And I don't really understand what the twisties is, but it's disorienting to the point where when you get up in the air on a flip and you lose sense of where you are. It's like, wow, like a vertigo kind of thing.
That's not a good thing. That's not a good thing if you're doing flips and shit way up in the air, right?
No, she had to withdraw from the games, and she took a ton of criticism for it and a bunch of people challenging her leadership. And I didn't expect that we'd see her train again and come all the way back to compete in another Olympic Games, but she is. And so I think that she's somebody to watch and maybe bet on. The other thing is, you know, this men's Olympic team, well, actually both the men's and the women's basketball teams, have not looked good coming. The men almost lost to South Sudan.
Really? I didn't know that.
How the F is that possible?
I like there might have been a little, what's his name, Porter fixing the bets on that one.
Oh, you think LeBron shaving points to make sure they don't cover against South Sudan? I don't know, but they might not. I mean, they didn't bring any real younger players on that. I mean, it's really just a bunch of the longtime NBA stars that like each other and hang out and are playing together. Yeah. It doesn't really seem like there's much of a plan other than five guys playing one-on-one while they're playing against other teams. And they're vulnerable. I mean, there's some good teams out there. So maybe betting on the other side of the men's basketball team.
Maybe so. You remember the original Dream Team didn't start out that hot either, right? Was it Jordan and Bird, or maybe not Jordan, but
yeah, Jordan, anyway. Bird, Magic.
Yeah, Jordan, Bird, Magic. Yeah, at Barkley, right?
Barkley.
And but anyway, let's get into my first story, right? And this has always fascinated me. Prisons have always fascinated me. Of course, I worked in the prisons, and I worked in the most notorious prison in the United States, except for this one, which isn't open any longer. And that's Alcatraz. Now, I'm pretty sure everybody's heard about the movie Escape from Alcatraz that had Clint Eastwood, et cetera. But let me tell you about the story, and then I'll tell you some more knowledge that I have on it. But the Alcatraz was supposed to be unescapable, kind of like Angola is, but you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And they had three inmates that escaped and were never found. And there's a lot of speculation about that. We'll get into it. But the speculation has long surrounded the fate of the infamous Alcatraz escapees. But there's a new book out that gives details that not only shed light on what happened, but also how the inmates might have used their childhood experiences to carry out the escape plan. Now, in June of 1962, the infamous trio of convicts, Frank Lee Morris, which was played by Clint Eastwood in the movie, and the brothers, John Anglin and Clarence Anglin, escaped Alcatraz, which has always been dubbed the Rock, right? It's supposed to be, you know, when they built it at the time, of course, they didn't think it was going to house as many inmates as it did, and it was for federal inmates, and as a badass place you didn't want to go. It's like the maximum security units now, the shoes and stuff that they have. Supposed to be unescapable. Well, the two brothers and Frank Lee Morris chipped through the walls, and they made a homemade raft, and they got off the island, but whether they escaped freedom or drowned or whatever, we don't know. But in the new book, Alcatraz, The Last Escape, authors Ken Widner and Mike Lynch examine why the trio was so confident in their daring plan and what they possibly did with their freedom. Now, Widner, the Anglin brothers' nephew, discusses the brothers' upbringing and claims that their childhood experiences prepared them for their escape. And he delves into how the Anglin brothers grew up poor and living in a cramped house with no plumbing, and says their upbringing gave them the resourcefulness to overcome difficult situations. It didn't matter what it was. They knew how to take nothing and make something out of it. Widner says the brothers were children of farm workers and were among 14 siblings. That's common back in the day. You had a farm, you knocked out a bunch of kids to help you, work on the farm, free labor. But the family built its four-room house itself, right? And the brothers were bullied because of their poverty and decided the way to earn respect was money at any cost. And now, naturally, they went to robbing banks. And after a 1958 bank robbery, John Anglin and Clarence Anglin, along with another Anglin brother, were sent to prison. And guess what? That's where they attempted their first escape. And John and Clarence were then sent to Alcatraz. I remember Alcatraz is like the place for problem childs, right? It's not what you do to get put into prison. It's how you act when you're in the prison. So they're sent to Alcatraz, and that's where they met Frank Morris, and they plotted their escape, right? Had nothing else to do 24 hours a day to sit around and think about freedom. So Winter says a key component of the skate was a tool fashioned from a spoon that was used to dig through the walls. My mom said they built their own bicycles. She told me how they built this car. They took the tires and filled them full of moss off the trees so the tires could roll. Pretty ingenious. But it's no surprise then that they were able to make various props, including dummy heads made out of plaster, paint, and hair taken from the prison barbershop, which they propped on their pillows to make it look like they were in their cells when the guards checked on them. And in some ways, the concept of the heads had been in the making their whole lives. The Ingram brothers reportedly enjoyed making dummies as kids and used them to escape their Florida reform school. The first time they actually they were in training from a, I always said that juvenile prisons and prisons are basically breeding grounds. It's like you and I going to college, right? They said they first actually used them. The first time they actually used them was when they would sneak out of the house as kids. And now Alcatraz is put there for a reason. And the San Francisco Bay is brutally cold with extreme currents presumed to make escape impossible. But the Anglins grew up on Florida's little Manatee River, where they learned to tie themselves to the back of boats to get towed down the river. Can't afford a set of skis. I guess that's what you do. Widener believes the brothers used this expertise in their escape. First, they would steal electrical cords, and then they would tie the cords to the boats to get towed across the bay after they left the island. Now, Fred Brizzy, a drug smuggler, offered this very explanation to the authors, suggesting that once the trio got towed into the middle of the bay, they were likely picked up by a boat, which took them to a small airport. And by the next day, according to Brizzy's theory, the three were in Mexico. In Mexico, the author says the three likely worked on a marijuana farm before escaping to Brazil in 1964. Now, we'll talk about this for a second. They're in Alcatraz. They're not in there for being fucking rich. They've been poor their whole lives. It's just like people say, you know, people escape from prison. Oh, they're going to run to Mexico and Brazil and all that. You don't have the money to get there, but I will continue. Widener shared a photos from the 1970s that he claimed shows the brothers in Brazil. He says, to me, that photo is probably the biggest game changer in the history of Alcatraz escape. It's been analyzed by five independent facial recognition software companies. They all come back for an exact match on John Anglin. With Clarence, it came back almost exact because his face was slightly turned. And the book is full of a bunch more details, y'all, many of which are backed up by family accounts. But let me tell you this. I saw these assholes on a documentary. I don't know if you saw this. I think on the History Channel or something, about the Alcatraz escape, and they went to Alabama or wherever the fuck it was to their shack they grew up in. They interviewed the family members, and supposedly one of the family members got a postcard from Brazil, and then they go to Brazil and they do all this investigation. That's just a bunch of fucking bullshit. Them dudes drown, bro. If any of them, there was one theory that Frank had made it to the shores of San Francisco and somebody picked him up and he died years later, wherever. But I don't believe they made it out. I mean, look, the Mississippi River, if you look at it like in Baton Rouge or where you're at, Mike, you'll see the different rip currents. Like you'll literally be watching the water going 40 miles an hour downstream, but then you'll see a 100-foot oak tree floating back up the river in the reverse direction. Yeah, I mean, those are getting out of that shit. And I know people that have swam in the Mississippi River their whole lives, like from St. Francisville. Actually, one of my buddies' dad was that's where my mom grew up in St. Francisville. They were all down there swimming and been swimming in their whole lives, and he just disappeared. And they never found until like 10 years ago when they were dredging, they found an old sunken barge and he was stuck under the barge. The skeletal remains were. Those dudes didn't get out. And that water, the Mississippi's warm compared to the water in San Fran Bay. say.
Oh yeah. So I can speak from direct experience. The very first time I went to San Francisco, which is 1986, I was out on a boat, a big sailboat, and my friend who lived there told me to jump off the front of the sailboat into the bay. We were anchored right off of Angel Island there. And by the time I jumped off the front of the boat and came up, I was at the back of a long, like a 40-foot sailboat.
Right.
And first of all, I'm a pretty good swimmer. Between the currents and the water temps, I mean, even if it's, I don't know what month they tried their escape, but even July and August, that water is still, maybe it's in the low 60s. I don't, and it doesn't get warm in that bay. It's a deep bay. And it's hard to believe anybody could have been prepared for what they would face there, but I don't know. So what do you make of the photo and the facial recognition? You're just zero chance these guys.
I think it was like a black and white photo, if I remember correctly, and they did that facial recognition. I still don't buy it. You make it all the way to Brazil and you work on a marijuana farm. It's just bullshit. Too good to be true.
The nephew or great nephew or whatever. Family member just trying to cash in. Yeah.
Same dude that did the documentary series, which I stupidly watched the whole thing. It's like DB Cooper, right? And you know, that asshole's dead somewhere in the woods. And I know they found some money and all that, but to this day, the conspiracy theory lives on.
Hey, everybody, it's Aggo. Listen up, especially you ladies over 40. I've got some good news. It's called Hormone Harmony. Hormone Harmony is an all-in-one hormonal balancing solution. It relieves symptoms of menopause. It promotes healthy weight loss and curbs cravings. It improves sleep quality. It reduces bloating and gas. It relieves hot flashes. It can even relieve occasional mood swings, although nothing like that has ever happened in my house. Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalance should take it, but it's perfect for the horrible menopause symptoms that make you put your life on hold. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use code RLRC at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and code RLRC at checkout for 15% off today.
Do you want to set your child up for success? Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with a subject? Is your child ahead, not getting challenged enough in class? IXL Learning is an online learning program that enriches your homeschool curriculum. It offers practice in math, English, language arts, science, and social studies while adapting to each child, meeting them where they are. Plus, IXL encourages students to be curious, empowers them how to choose to learn. Now, Cindy used IXL in the classroom as a teacher and now uses it to homeschool our youngest son in the 9th grade. The videos are what she finds that benefits him most in math because he's a very visual learner. The perfect supplement to your homeschool curriculum, IXL offers interactive practice problems, educational game lessons, and video tutorials for every topic you're teaching at home. It's easy to use, time-saving, and everything on IXL is organized by grade, subject, topic, and subtopic, making it simple to find activities for the exact skills you're covering. Instant grading, helpful progress reporting, IXL offers instant feedback and explanations of new topics as kids use the program. Flexible and personalized. Kids can explore any topic in any grade level. They aren't forced into a single learning path like they are on other programs. If you're homeschooling your child because they were falling behind or because they were too far ahead, IXL is a great program to help them get the exact support they need. It's fun for kids, and kids love IXL's positive feedback, awards, and educational games. And it's trustworthy. IXL is trusted by 15 million students worldwide and has proven to improve performance in over 75 scientific research studies. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Real Life Real Crime listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/RLRC. So visit IXL.com/RLRC to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. We use it on our son, WL. It's an amazing product, y'all. You can thank me later.
Okay, well, I think I am right there with you, Woody. But for those who want to do a deeper dive, this book is out, right? It's called Alcatraz, The Last Escape. And Ken Widener, W-I-D-N-E-R, is the author who is related to the Anglins.
Yep.
Okay, Woody. Yeah. So we are back again talking about my podcast series called With the Benefit of Hindsight, the story of the Penn State scandal. This week, we move on to episodes 5 and 6 of that podcast series, which document the stories of victim number 6 is actually the story in episode 5, and victim number 1 is the story in episode 6. I think one of the things that gets confusing for people as you read along is the victim numbers don't correspond to chronologically when the incidents occur. They correspond to when that victim became became part of the case, a plaintiff in the case. Before we dig into what happens, I did want to interject a little personal perspective. So I attended this large public high school on Long Island. Junior high and high school was 1974 to 1980 for me. So back in the olden days. But I played football and baseball for all 6 of those years. And after every practice and after every game, every one of the players on the team, the coaches, the assistant coaches, managers, everyone all showered up in a big shower room with 20 or 30 shower heads. I mean, this happened on a daily basis. I showered with Lenny Butler, Jack Bradish, Ted Nagengast, Ted's son, little Teddy Jr. Those were all coaches of mine in high school. And, you know, Teddy Jr. was maybe 12 years old at the time. And so the incident we'll learn about today came 18 years later than my high school graduation. Okay. This is the story we learn about in episode 5 of the podcast, happened in 1998. And so it's 20 years later, but I'm told that this practice that I went through in high school, and I think Woody, you probably did as well, was still very much common practice across the country up until about that time. And I think it was really when the Catholic Church scandal hit that there was a massive rethink all the way across the country about this ritual of team showering, coaches, managers, all of that kind of stuff. And people began to watch it a lot more closely. And one of the things that really gets to me in the story of the Penn State scandal is the way that things are presented makes you believe that there were these private shower stalls and that Sandusky was taking kids into private shower stalls. That's not true. They're just like I had in high school and Woody, you probably had. These are big public shower areas where the Penn State football team, the Penn State hockey team, et cetera, with 20, 30, however many shower heads existed. And so there should have been no expectation of privacy, is my point. And if you're a predator and you're looking to get away with a crime, you're not really the place you would choose to do your molesting. But anyway, and just a little bit about Sandusky. Sandusky was the son of Polish immigrants, first generation, and he grew up in this small town of Washington, Pennsylvania, which is like 50 miles south of Pittsburgh. His father got asked by the town to rebuild a rec center that had burnt down. And in order to do that, they had to, the Sandusky family had to sell their old home and then move into this rec center, which was called Brownson House. And that is where Sandusky grew up. So he grew up in like a YMCA, grew up in this big rec center where there was only one big shower room for men or boys, one big shower room for girls or women. And so he grew up in this environment where he played sports all day with other people that were at the rec center. And he showered up every day with coaches and other players in that rec center. So this was sort of the lifestyle he grew up in. And he had great admiration for his father, and it had been his dream to sort of recreate what had been done with Brownson House when he created the Second Mile. So the Second Mile was sort of him saying thank you to his father and trying to give back. And the Second Mile was purely focused on underprivileged kids in central Pennsylvania and providing them an outlet, primarily sports. So all kinds of different sports activities and camps that originally started in just the State College area, but grew to be literally statewide after Sandusky became famous and the team won its national championship. So for Sandusky, something that you know we see as gross or abhorrent, especially younger people might today, he understood that as being normal. It's what he grew up with. It's the way that teams at Penn State handled things. And so being in the shower with mostly teenage boys was not that unusual of a thing. And so, you know, the narrative from the prosecution and the media in this case made it sound like Sandusky was taking, you know, these one-on-one showers with boys. The two shower incidents in the case took place in those large shower rooms, as I talked about. That's not to say that Sandusky shouldn't, you know, at that point in time, whether it was 1998 or 2008, which is the timing of the alleged second incident, that he shouldn't have been aware by that point in his life that it wasn't appropriate to be showering with boys. I mean, he should have been. I think by that time, most of us were, but for whatever reason, he wasn't. He was wrong to have done it, but I think it was more out of his naivete. And there's a big difference between, you know, naivete about social mores. Then there's a big difference between that and child abuse. And so today we're discussing episodes 5 and 6. The two episodes focus on the stories of two alleged Sandusky victims: a boy named Zach Constis, who became victim number 6, and a boy who became victim number 1 by the name of Aaron Fisher. Zach Constis, the subject of episode 5, was 11 years old in May of 1998, and he was an active participant in the Second Mile charity. Jerry took Zach over to Penn State one day, and the two of them worked out at the Penn State facilities. At the end of the workout, they took a shower together. At some point during the shower, Zach, who was short for his age, was lifted. He was 11 years old at the time. Was lifted up by Sandusky so that he could rinse the soap out of his hair. Sandusky dropped Zach off at his house after the workout, and Zach's mother, a woman by the name of Deborah McCord, who we will hear from throughout the remainder of the story, asks Zach why his hair is wet. Zach tells his mother that he and Jerry took a shower in the Penn State locker room after their workout. She's disturbed to hear this, and she asks Zach if Sandusky touched him in his privates, or if Zach touched Sandusky, if anything made him feel weird about it. And Zach answered no to all of those questions. But despite Zach's answers, Deborah McCord decided to call Child Youth Services and file a complaint anyway. An investigation was subsequently started, and officers Scheffler and Lauro were running the investigation. The officers decided, along with McCord, to arrange a sting where McCord asked Jerry to come to her house, and a conversation between McCord and Sandusky was to be recorded when Sandusky arrived at the house. They were attempting to get him to admit that he had done something sexual with Zach. And Sandusky absolutely denied there being any sexual nature to anything that that he had done. He apologized for it and promised that he would never work out with Zach or have him take a shower there again. But he felt very, very bad about it for a particular reason. He was told that Zach was a cancer patient, which later we learned was not true. Zach had wanted really badly to attend Penn State events and to be able to come to practices in campus with Sandusky. And Jerry was afraid that the boy was not going to be allowed to do that any longer. And so he felt very, very bad about it. There's a story that came out of that where people claim that Sandusky said, "I wish I was dead," to Zach's mother, Deborah. Sandusky denies ever having said it. No recording was ever produced of him saying it. According to Sandusky, is something he would never say, and he hadn't even said it at the point that he was in jail for several years. And so he out and out denies that he can't swear 1,000% that he didn't say it, but it is very much unlike him. He doesn't think he said it, and there was never any documentation produced that he did say it. The investigators come to visit Sandusky, and while this is going on, Sandusky didn't know he was under surveillance. So he had no idea during that conversation with McCord that he was being recorded or watched by the police. The investigators visited him in the Penn State locker room days later and informed him that he had been under investigation. And they discussed the incident and the results of their investigation. They told him that they didn't find any evidence of any kind of sexual abuse, that the incident would be declared unfounded, and that it would be expunged from the records. And so, in other words, the case would disappear as if it had never existed because they found no evidence of anything. The one thing they did ask Sandusky to do was to not work out or shower with Zach at Penn State again. And Sandusky and Zach both say that Sandusky lived up to that. Now, you would think if there was some kind of actual abuse that had occurred in 1998, that the mother, that Zach would not have wanted much to do with Sandusky after that incident, but the exact opposite is true. Zach continued to be a big part of Second Mile. He continued to have a relationship with Jerry. Deborah McCord continued a relationship with Jerry. In fact, Deborah McCord went to Jerry Sandusky begging for Sandusky to allow Zach to come with him to Sandusky's retirement game in 1999 against the University of Michigan. And so Zach was allowed to continue with Sandusky, attend games with Sandusky. In fact, he continued a relationship with Sandusky well into his adulthood. The story was leaked, as we may recall, in March of 2011 by that Cub reporter, Sarah Ganim, saying that there was an investigation of Sandusky possibly abusing boys from Second Mile. And in July of that year, he went out to dinner with Zach and also with victim number two, whose story we'll find out later. In fact, what we'll find as we go through all of these stories is that every single one of these victims maintained relationships with Sandusky and his family long after their abuse had supposedly occurred. And I just would suggest to you that if you think, I know if it was me, if something like that happened to my child, or I thought that it did, even if it didn't get prosecuted, I would not have my child hanging around that person, or certainly not alone with that person, or being any part of that person's life. Zach actually frequently wrote Jerry letters, one in particular, telling him how happy he was that he had come into his life. And so that's the story of what happened in that 98 incident. But what happens after that is, so this thing happens in 98. It's ruled unfounded. It's to be expunged. It's not supposed to exist as far as anybody should be concerned. But when the investigation into allegations brought in 2008 by Aaron Fisher, who's victim number one, is going on, somehow that record from 98 had not been expunged. It resurfaces and it is used as evidence of Sandusky being a pedophile and Penn State supposedly knowing for 10 years that he was. So after the unfounded ruling, Sandusky and Zach resumed all their activities, as I said. Deborah McCord continued her relationship with him. That relationship continued into adulthood. When Ganim published her story back in March of 11, prosecutors were expecting that victims were going to, you know, come flying out of the woodwork. But no one does. Sarah Ganim ends up texting Deborah McCord, telling her that if more victims don't come forward, the case is going to be dropped. The grand jury process is supposed to be private, anonymous, secret. There's only one way Sarah Ganim gets Deborah McCord's number. It's leaked to her. And so we have a newspaper reporter being used by prosecutors to try and bring more victims to the table. Ganim texts McCord telling her that the case is soon to be dropped if more victims can't be found. And Deborah McCord really goes to work recruiting other kids to become victims. Magically, three other kids, all friends of Zach Constas, Deborah's son, come forward before the November press conference and the presentment. Victim number four, victim number five, and victim number seven that come forward in the interim are all good friends of Zach's. So now we have a guy who's running a program with thousands of kids participating in the program, where he's supposedly a criminal mastermind. And he's chosen to abuse four friends, but those friends have never shared anything with each other about being victims of Jerry Sandusky. Those four friends are actually pictured along with a couple of other kids in Jerry Sandusky's book, which is called Touched. It just, again, criminal mastermind, are you going to abuse four kids who are friendly with each other and put a picture of them in your book? I don't think that would happen. So the 1998 case, you know, should have, or at least could have, exonerated Sandusky and the administrators, and that's a point that Ziegler makes strongly. And instead of the fact that there was an investigation 10 years ago into Sandusky that found no evidence of anything and that he was exonerated and the case was to be expunged, should have been proof that Sandusky was not a pedophile. But instead, in this upside down world of the Penn State scandal, it becomes evidence that Sandusky is a pedophile and that the administrators were guilty of covering up Sandusky's crimes. Okay.
That's like the longest I've ever been quiet in my entire life. I have hundreds of thousands of hours of interview and interrogation. And if I don't ask the question when it's on the tip of my tongue, I forget it. And I listened to these episodes actually in full, and I got so much, but there's no way we can get to it all today, but I'm going to start with, Zach was the one that was picked up in the shower with bear hug, right? And he lathers up his head and all that shit. Now listen, I showered, with other players, never with my coaches and whatever, but at what point, now he's 11 years old or however old he was, and he was short in stature. But you know what? I'm pretty fucking sure he can wash his own hair, right? And you pick up a kid, I'm not saying anything, this is the episodes, and look, it's well reported from one angle at least. But there's some common sense things in here that need to be looked at also. I don't care who you are, what your position is. If you are showering with a 11-year-old boy, I don't care what fucking year it is. You're showering with an 11-year-old boy and you decide to pick him up. You're naked. He's naked. You put him in a bear hug and you're saying you're soaping up his hair and all that because maybe he couldn't reach it or whatever. That doesn't look well. Even if you're not a fucking pedophile, that shouldn't happen. Period. I mean, you want somebody picking up your boys when they were that age in the shower. You want a coach picking them up and showering their hair? Is that okay? Would you want one of your son's basketball coaches picking them up when they're butt naked, giving them a bear hug and soaping up his head? I'm asking you, Mike.
Okay. I was trying to be quiet like you were for me. The bear hug language is language that only came into it during the trial, during the explanation of what had happened that night originally. There was no bear hug. The bear hug was brought in later to make it seem like
Would you want any one of your son's coaches when they were 11 years old to pick them up in the shower, period? Period. Bear hug, no bear hug. I mean, you pick them up, you having skin on skin contact, no matter what part of the body it is. Then you picking them up and you're shampooing their head. You're either holding them by one arm up against your body and shampooing their head. I mean, you have to have skin on skin contact. That is not fucking okay with me, or I would think any other parent, including you, that your son's coach or Boy Scout leader or Catholic priest or any priest, anybody is in a fucking shower, a public shower. And you keep making that point about public shower. I never thought that this was that they were saying this was a private shower stall. I always pictured the big locker room shower things, but you know, I'm not saying that they did anything, like anal penetration or oral sex or anything like that in a shower, but the, you wouldn't. And most pedophiles, I told you, situational preferential. And if Jerry is guilty, he would definitely be a preferential. And they use the position of power to groom their victims and all that shit. But the thing being is you're not going to have the sex in an open public shower. He's not fucking stupid, but you certainly, or if you're a pedophile and you're looking at, you know, the age range victim that you like to fend against, and you're naked and he's naked and you could pick him up, and you're going to have skin on skin contact, and you're soaping up his head. You may be putting that in your spank bank, or you probably are putting that in your spank bank for later on. He's not stupid. Jerry Sandusky is not an idiot. He's not going to just do it right there in the shower, let his emotions take him away and do a rape in the shower. And secondly, the whole thing about Zach and them and his friends. Let's talk about that.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 today. If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
I know this for a fact. On a case that I work, and I can't say anything about it because I have NDAs and everything else from the powers that fucking be on it. The same guy in a position of power authority, and I won't say which one because I can't, over the years, and every time he offended or it found out that he was offending. Now, he ingratiated himself to all these families, power position of authority, and he would fend against the young boys. And if this is like a long fucking time ago, in the 70s and shit. And so there was no internet and no whatever. And, you know, whenever it got found out or alleged, the crowd, whatever, however it may have happened, this person got moved to another place where he's still in position of authority by the powers that were over him, right? And so, but it was a pattern of his. Once you got one kid in to do it, to get him to get his friends to come over. And yes, I know I heard it in the episodes that it was never alleged Jerry used porn or alcohol and all that, but they don't always use that. And then in this case that I'm talking about, the guy did. He would start out floating it out, hey, have a beer, float out a porno magazine, and, you know, see if he'd get the friends aroused and say, hey, this is natural. It was the same thing every time. Now, but he didn't do it on every one of them. Some of them he might have floated a little softball out that we'll never know about. And the whether he got bad vibes about it or whatever, he didn't try to offend against that kid, right? And even though the kid had spent the night at the house like the other kids did, and then numerous of them were packs of friends that were it started with one. Hey, can you get another friend to come over? Started with two, but they think, you know, and you think about it, I keep hearing him say, oh, he's a heterosexual male, da da da. Look, when you're 11, 12 years old, you're developing sexually, and you trust this person. Like for real, like your family trusts him, you trust him, and he gets you alone and you spend the night at his house or whatever it may be. And you develop this
relationship. He buys you shit. And in this case, it was whistling bottle rockets that I'm talking about. He'd buy him fireworks and shit like that. But the get him over there and, it, you know, the kids think that every one of them thought that this person loved him. That's the truth. And Zach's in the letters later on, even a Father's Day card saying, I love you. And the another letter, oh, I'm so glad you came in my life, as he gets older, right? But the a huge part of the offending on this type of offender is the control that they have over their victims. They 99% of them go on to have productive adult lives, get married, all the rest of the shit. They don't think they're gay. They think that this person saying, oh, you know, I love you and this is natural, but don't tell because people really wouldn't understand. We don't want to get in trouble, what have you. And they ingrain it into them. And they go on and have a relationship. Another one. And this guy, I can say, because I'm not bound by anything, he was a preacher and a famous gospel music singer. And he did it with his niece and nephew, and they got them to bring their best friend in. And when I went and interviewed the niece and the nephew all the years later, like, fuck, don't tell. But yeah, it's true. And he, after church on Sunday nights, we'd have the sex parties. He got us into it and everything else and got us to bring our friend in. And they're married. They got kids now. Shit. The other guy, I was like, fuck him. I'll tell the story. Right. And he's the one that brought it forward. So you can't file every case under it was a public shower. So nothing happened. Well, fuck it. So what? And Sandusky's not stupid. I'm saying if he is this person, we're going to continue the series. He's not going to do it in a public shower. Right. And the fact that they continued relationships for years afterwards, that didn't mean dick. Then other than if he's guilty, then he was a mastermind and a master manipulator and able to do it. Now, I know there's a lot that's going to come out about the money and, but the one mom, what's dickhead's mom? And I don't believe that guy's being totally honest, but coming outside and saying, I'm going to own his house. Well, you know what? She didn't come outside and say, I'm going to kill that motherfucker. So, you know, she's poor and that's probably to her, that means more than putting a bullet in this asshole if he's guilty. But it's just so much on it, Mike. And I know I'll shut up for a second because then I'll go off on my next tangent, but you can't put, and I'm just tell you one thing I kind of took offense at and in the series when they were talking about where this kid was from. The poor area that he was from, like, oh, it's way back. I'm summarizing. Oh, basically, it's way back in the holler, and that's what people do in rural areas. That's fucking bullshit. You can't. There's no more kids that get raped in rural areas than there are offended against in rural areas than there are in cities, and that gives just people that live in rural areas a bad name. And then I understand that, you know, that people from the city may think, oh. And I always joke and say when they live so far out of the country, when they got electricity, they cut the birth rate in half. But that shit is just not true. And it's not proven by any facts or statistics. And that's a slap to the face, to everyone that's ever grown up in an area like that. But go ahead.
Okay. So I agree with you that it is, whether it was back in 1998 or today, it's inappropriate for adult men to be showering with 11-year-old boys. I do. I wouldn't want a coach of my kid doing it. I certainly wouldn't do it.
Showering is one thing. Picking up and lathering your head is another.
All of it. Inappropriate. Yeah. And right. So I agree with you. But it was investigated. Fully okay. Investigated. And the right. Results of that investigation were a kid saying, you never touched me anywhere weird. He never asked me to touch him anywhere weird. I didn't right. Think anything of it. If Sandusky had been concerned about it, I think he would have dried the kid's hair. Probably never would have come up. Hey, right?
What did he allege at trial?
At trial, he, his basic story was that when all these other stories came out, he came to see what happened to him in a different light. And while Jerry never abused him, he believed, at least, and I think number six, I think one of the things that's unique about number six is
he got the least amount of money.
I think he's actually a good person who was honest. Like, I can believe his story all the way through, where some of the others are just completely ridiculous. I think that he came to look upon that incident as, based upon all the other things that he learned, that Jerry was likely grooming him, but it just, for whatever reason, decided he wasn't going to abuse him.
I can tell you the reason, because he got investigated for it. And he's like, fuck that. I continue the relationship and everything else, but I'm not doing anything with this boy. Right now, him coming out years later, and it just, I know you don't think this is so, but I know there's some shitheads that are going to go in there for the dollar. I get that after everybody else comes out. But the therapy shit is a real deal. People blocking out their memories is a real deal. And they come back and look, I know it's real, because after that goes, and then I go to the offender, I was fortunate enough to get a confession from the offender saying, yep, you're right. And these people have blocked it out for all these years. And I don't know, you go ahead.
But Woody, as we'll see, every one of these kids, because their stories all changed and changed a lot over time, mm-hmm. and changed in such a way as to, once they learned what Penn State was paying for, once they learned what got the bigger checks, their stories all changed to move them into the kind of abuse that would get them the bigger checks. But you don't have, first of all, repressed memory therapy is not accepted in court. It has,
neither are polygraphs. Doesn't mean that it didn't work.
Okay. But every single one of these victims was told the cops nothing ever happened to them. And then once it became known that Penn State was paying millions of dollars to victims, and once therapists got involved and treated these guys, they all of a sudden remembered things. They've now, maybe that therapy might work on, maybe you might have one kid, maybe you might have somehow two kids, but you're not going to have every single victim saying the same thing, which is that through therapy, the memories came back to them. And but we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. Yeah. I think to wrap up episode five and the story around Zach is, I think Zach has been an honest as a young man and honest as an adult, in that what happened in the shower back in 98 happened in the shower. He continued his relationship with Sandusky and saw him as a father figure. When the stories come out about all of these other victims, he sort of rethinks his childhood a little bit and sees himself as probably somebody who Sandusky targeted, but decided for whatever reason not to abuse. You actually, for the first time, brought up a very good reason why Sandusky might not have done that if he was guilty. I've actually never heard anybody come back and say that, but it makes good sense that if he was already investigated for that kid, he probably wants to stay away from that kid. But anyway, that's Zach's story.
I don't want to end just yet. I got a couple more things on it. And I agree with you on Zach's situation. Okay. You got to think again, 11-year-old boy, you know, thinking back years later, but you know, when you're 11 or 10 or 11, whatever, you may think that's weird or whatever, but you don't get it in the sexual context, right? And then all these years later, even though you maintain the relationship, et cetera, and you're hearing all these other stories, it
whether regardless of whether or not they're true. It, like you said, you're a grown ass man now, and you're like, ooh, wait a minute. That, you know, maybe I was being groomed. And I think I agree with you. I think that dude's telling the truth. And correct me if I'm wrong, he got the least amount of money out of anybody, right?
He did, because he didn't, and I think he probably was very aware from his mother, attorneys, therapists, what he could do to embellish things.
Right.
That would have gotten him a lot more money, and right. he chose not to do it. So that's right. why I look at him and go, I think we have an honest broker in, right. in Zach. I think he was truthful throughout.
I agree with you on that. And then I totally agree, and I've worked the cases where the people, when they're adults, I mean, look, and I know I'm getting ahead of selves, but every time a new story would come on about a certain individual, we'd get a new fucking report. And some of them found it because I got the confession out of the individual, right? And I know you say the media, they had to get more victims and all that. I think probably someone did call this lawyer and is giving tips. Look, I'm going to say the swim hasn't, but these motherfuckers were shitheads. But I wasn't doing it to fish for more victims, or swim wasn't doing it to fish for more victims. He was doing it because he wanted a perp walk when swim took the person out of the car and marched him out of the courthouse, whatever, in handcuffs. He wanted the news cameras there so this asshole could be seen. But I think probably somebody called this cub reporter and said whatever. She does contact the mom. It's like, hey, they're saying there's not going to be any charges if there's more victims that come for it. And then the mom goes and does it on her own. I don't think the reporter's like, ooh, go out there and get them victims, right? But she tells them what was told to her. And then the mom takes it upon herself for financial reasons or whatever reason it may be. I think it's just a lot to it that this reported one way. And I think it's a great job reporting, but it's reported one way. But when you look at it simple, like Zach as an adult, not being offended against because he had been investigated. Fuck, they told him don't do it again. And he's like, fuck, that was a close one. But we'll get into it. I think the next kid, what's his?
Aaron,
Mama
Aaron
says,
Fisher.
I'm my own in the house. Aaron Fisher, because you know I'm bad with names. I think we should talk about that cat next. I delved into him, and there's good and bad on, certainly bad shade on him, but there's also things that I think maybe you're not thinking about. So, but anyway,
I'm very anxious to hear what those are, because I think that I think that this guy is about as awful as anyone involved.
There's definitely y'all. We'll post a link to it again. And actually, somebody sent me. I'll send it to you, Mike. I think you wrote it. Somebody sent me a long article. It almost breaks down these series verbatim.
Yeah, I wrote it. It's a summary of the series.
And I was like, fuck, I already listened to 4 hours of that. however many hours with the one episode and this one. I think I've listened to more of this podcast than I have of my own podcast over the years. And we're on like episode 5 or 6, but
probably not yet. But by the end, it's 60 hours of audio.
That's crazy, but I get it. Anyway, interesting. But y'all go listen to, is episode 6 about this?
Yes, episode 6 is called the Aaron Fisher story. It's called Family Affair, the Aaron Fisher story. And so, episode we'll 6 is the story of victim number 1. His name is Aaron Fisher, and his story is the one that began the grand jury investigation into Sandusky. It began in November of 2008. So it's interesting. The first two incidents involving Sandusky come 10 years apart. There's 1998, and then there's not another accusation by anybody until 2008. And both of those accusations are not made by the kids that were supposedly touched or abused. They're made by the mothers of those.
Yeah.
And so
Fisher's
mother.
Go ahead. I was just going to tell them to listen to it because it's too fucking long. I want them to hear everything. And there's certainly some bad shit on Fisher. No doubt about it. But there's also some things that are just fit right in. And I know.
I'm looking forward to hearing this from.
Whether on the defense side or the prosecution side, the argument can be made that you can put the round peg in a square hole if you really want the motherfucker to go in. But this kid's story, or this adult now story, is so interesting from an investigator standpoint because you know he's lying about some of them. But I also believe there's some truth nuggets in there.
Okay, so Fisher's mother, Dawn Fisher, is an... You can see in the social media that she loves to party.
Yeah.
And she is very excited to go out on a particular Friday night. And the plan is that her son, Aaron Fisher, who is a part of the Second Mile, is going to join Sandusky and some other Second Mile kids for a night out. So Sandusky is her babysitter for the night, if you will. But Fisher doesn't want to go with Sandusky. And he gets in a argument with his mother in the front of her house, telling her that Jerry's creepy, that Jerry makes him feel weird, that he puts his hand on my knee, that he puts his arm around me when we walk. He's just weird, and I don't want to go with you. This all happens in front of her next-door neighbor, a guy by the name of Josh Fervell, and then the two of them, Dawn and Aaron, go into the house for about 20 minutes, 30 minutes. So Fervellis doesn't know what they're saying to each other when they go into the house for that 20 or 30 minutes. And then Dawn comes out of the house and walks into Fervell's house. And the first words out of her mouth are, "I'm going to own that motherfucker's house." And Fervell says, Sandusky's house. I'm going to own that motherfucker's house.
Yeah.
And the Fishers live in a town called Lock Haven, Pennsylvania. Lock Haven is 30. Yeah.
You're telling the whole episode. You're telling the whole, this episode 6. And you know, they need to listen to it and cover it well, because that's like a 4-hour episode in, you know,
we told everybody this week to listen to both episode 5 and episode 6 because we would be covering them.
But there's no way that we're already over an hour, and we can't do this kid's whole episode. There's no fucking way. Let them listen to it for the, you know, really listen. And I can promise you, I wouldn't think anybody would. Hardly anybody besides me listened to both of those episodes. And I had 6 hours of drive time, and I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. But I want it to be fresh, and fresh on them and fresh on us. And I think that's a fair way to do it, is take a victim by victim. And we had Zach today, and we'll have him next time.
Some of the other victims, for sure, we'll be able to double up on, because their stories aren't nearly
as... This guy, to my credit, and I'm not just trying to cut it short because I got shit to go do, but I do. But this guy is a bit of a douchebag. There's no doubt about it. But I think there's some things in there that you're missing, and that's why I want to take my time and be able to get into it.
Okay. Well, I'm really, really anxious to hear those. So we do want to do that. So when we come back next week, we'll dig through all of episode 6, the story of Aaron Fisher, and that'll give everybody who hasn't had a chance to listen to it a chance to listen to it.
And listen, I don't know if you've been going to the crew page, Mike, and then the app. They got forums that are actually talking about this, and Joshua E. Barb, and a bunch of them are talking about it. So y'all continue to comment. In those sections, I think it's important. The discussion is very good, and it's really only going to get better. I want to know you know, what y'all think about what's going on so far. So thank you for, listening.
We're really getting into the juicy part of this, learning about the victims. Yeah. And then we will go through the trial and, there's a lot.
That's where the meat's at.
All right, dude.
You remember that old Wendy's commercial? Where's the beef? Yeah,
sure.
I don't know. I just popped in my head, but anyway. All right. Thank you. All right. And anyway, thank you. And thank all y'all. We love you and appreciate each and every one of you and all that good podcaster shit.
All that good podcaster shit. All right. Thanks, Aglets. Talk to you guys on Friday.
Peace. Oh, oh, oh,
O'Reilly. You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people. Oh, 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 O'Reilly.